Church history is full of epic declarations by Christians on trial for their faith. Standing trial, the famous beginner of the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther, is said to have declared, "It cannot be right for a Christian to speak against his conscience. Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise." Polycarp, the aged and magisterial bishop of Smyrna, was brought into the arena to die a martyr's death. And the proconsul said, "Polycarp, renounce Jesus and say, 'Down with the atheists.'" Understanding that the word atheist to the Romans referred to Christians because the Christians rejected the belief in any of the Roman gods and they only believed in the one God, Jesus. So they were Christians were called atheists. And Polycarp was told, "Reject the atheists, say, 'Down with the atheists.'" And Polycarp looked at thousands of people cheering for his death and he said, "Down with these atheists." He said, "Okay." He says, "Don't you understand?" The proconsul said, "Polycarp, I have wild animals that I will throw to you if you do not repent and renounce Jesus." "Then call them," Polycarp said. "Why are you delaying? Bring them out." Finally, he said, "If you despise the animals, Polycarp, I will have you burned." Polycarp replied, "You threaten me with fire, which burns for an hour and then is extinguished. But you know nothing of the fire of the coming judgment and eternal punishment reserved for the ungodly. Why are you waiting? Bring on what you want." Sooner or later, many Christians are going to stand trial in some form or another for the truth of Jesus Christ. And yet the privilege to testify for Christ before men is the chance to give witness to the truth. And the confession that Christians give, like all confessions in church history, is merely an echo of the glorious confession that Jesus Christ gave when he himself stood trial. Our sermon title today is called "The Glorious Confession," and it refers obviously to Jesus when he was standing trial himself and he was put under oath by the high priest to declare, is he or is he not the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? And Jesus under oath told the truth, "I am." That glorious confession. We're going to see why it is. I want to go through four headings, take the text through four headings. And the first one is incognito. The second one is innocence. And the third one is identity. And the fourth is indictment. So incognito, innocence, identity, and indictment. So looking first under incognito, look again with me at verses 53 and 54. "They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, elders, and teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and there he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire." Remember in our previous passage that Peter and the disciples abandoned Jesus when they slapped the handcuffs on him, fulfilling Jesus' prophecy given merely hours before it happened. There is a great hymn called "Stricken, Smitten, and Afflicted" that says in the second stanza, "Tell me, ye who hear him groaning, was there ever grief like his? Friends through fear his cause disowning, foes insulting his distress." So after Peter, we find, abandons Jesus, he goes incognito. He follows Jesus and the group from a safe distance, careful not to be seen by anyone. And according to John's gospel, John and Peter were both following Jesus. And what happened apparently was that when they arrived to the high priest's house, John, according to his gospel, was someone who knew the high priest and therefore was given access into the house of the high priest. And then he came back out to get Peter and give Peter access into the house of the high priest also, which explains why he was allowed to be able to come in and enter into the high priest's courtyard. And so Peter is found to go over to a fire and warm himself, concealing his identity. He's hanging around the guards who just arrested Jesus. They don't know who he is. They don't recognize him. John goes into, apparently, the room, according to John's gospel, goes into the room where Jesus was being interrogated by the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law. So John is able to give certain details that perhaps others like Mark and Matthew and Luke were not able to give because John was in the room. John was in the room, watching and hearing everything. But here's where I'm kind of going with this. Peter's out in the courtyard. Peter's gathered with the guards, warming himself by the fire, trying his hardest not to be noticed, and that is what stands out to me, how Peter is trying to blend in with the enemies of Christ, trying to look more like those who are against Christ than look like Christ. This is the point I'm going to, is how incognito he is. He's giving it his all to stay hidden. You heard Jesus say, or Peter heard Jesus say things like this: you do not light a lamp and then put it under a basket. You don't take something that gives off light and then shroud its light. Yet Peter was concealing his light. Jesus said, "Let your light shine before men," in Matthew chapter 5, but Peter tried to hide his light in the midst of men. Philippians 2 says that you should shine like the stars shine in the universe. Stars don't blend into the black backdrop. They are distinct from the backdrop in that the darkness behind them makes them sparkle and glitter all the more brightly. And yet Peter did not glitter and sparkle with the light of Christ. Peter was in the darkness in that moment in more ways than one. Here's the thing. Fear is winning with Peter, not faith. Fear will make you conceal your relationship to Christ. Faith will make you stand with Jesus. And when you stand with Jesus, you will stand out. Anyone who is ashamed of me before men, I will be ashamed of him before my Father in heaven. And so here is the admonition pastorally to us as a church, as the bride of Christ, is this: despise the opinions of men. Despise whatever is in you that would make you feel ashamed of Jesus Christ when you stand before men. And here's the key to help you do this. Here's the key that I find over is what helps me get better and better, and I need to get better and better at not being embarrassed of Jesus Christ. But here is the key. The key is love. You will never be ashamed of that which you love. Never. 1 John chapter 4, verse 18 says, perfect love drives out what? Fear. Now, in one sense, that means that when you understand the perfect love that God has for you, it drives out any fear that you may have of God, and you will run openly to Him. But in another sense, it means that when the perfect love of God comes in and works in your heart so that you are perfectly able to love someone, you will never be afraid of loving that someone. And when it comes to Jesus Christ, you won't care what anyone thinks of your love for Jesus Christ. There will be no fear where there is love. If you love Him with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, there is not a little door girl or a Goliath who will ever scare you enough to make you embarrassed of Jesus. Never. Love Him and despise the opinions of men. Secondly, we see innocence, the innocence of Jesus. Now, if you're in Mark with me, follow along verse 55 through 59. It says the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they didn't find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and they gave this false testimony against him. Yeah, we heard him say that I will destroy this man-made temple and in 3 days will build another not made by man. Yet even then their testimony did not agree. So the Sanhedrin is like the supreme court in Israel. They ruled all religious and civil affairs in the nation of Israel. It was a group comprised of 70 very prestigious and powerful and intellectual men. They came from groups like the Sadducees or the Pharisees. And you had chief priests, and you had a high priest, and you had previous high priests and chief priests who were still all associated. And in this group, you would have no doubt had the disciples of many of these very learned, very religious men. It was part of this group that Joseph of Arimathea, who comes to bury Jesus at the end, belongs. It is Nicodemus in John chapter 3 who comes in the cloak of night to Jesus and asks him about being born again. Okay, that Nicodemus belongs to this group, the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin hated Jesus so much that they violated nearly every rule that they had in place to safeguard, prevent the condemning of innocent men. I want to bring out 6 of these rules and these policies that they had, these legal procedures that they violated in order to get Jesus killed. First of all was this. Jesus was condemned before he even had a trial. Jesus was condemned before he had a trial. They had already determined that he must die before there was any trial. In other words, they had no evidence. They didn't have a case, but they had a verdict. Now they just needed to go and get a case. They needed witnesses. Notice the wording in verse 55. It says, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Listen, guilt needs to be determined at the accumulation and the evaluation of evidence, not before. It is a complete travesty of justice that you can walk up to a man and put him to death without having any evidence of him doing anything worthy of being put to death. He was condemned before he had a trial. Even Nicodemus protested in John chapter 7. When the guards returned to the Sanhedrin empty-handed and they did not arrest Jesus like they were instructed to do, Nicodemus protested to the Sanhedrin. He said, doesn't our own law even say that we cannot condemn a man until he has had a trial? And then what do they do? Do they check themselves in that moment? No, they heap insults on Nicodemus. Oh, are you one of them too? One of them Galileans? See, the slurs and the insults. You know, when you don't have facts and when you don't have a real legitimate case, you resort to mockery and insults and slander, and you try all the ad hominem attacks that you can to bury someone. And that's exactly what they tried to do to Nicodemus. Guilt should be determined after evidence is produced, not before. But, as Jesus said in the previous passage, alas, this is your hour. The hour of darkness reigns. Secondly, the second way they violated their own legal procedures was that according to Jewish law, no trial was to take place at night, and trials were to take place in public. Yet Jesus was arrested and stood 2 trials at night and both in private. He stood before Annas and then he stood before Caiaphas afterwards. The third way that they violated Jewish procedures was that Jesus could not be arrested and interrogated first before witnesses were produced. In other words, every case has to be built on witnesses who came ahead of time to present their case so that they could then have just cause to go and arrest someone. But what they did with Jesus is they went and they got him arrested and they brought him in and then they said, now, okay, how are we going to make this work? What is the case that we can pin on him to justify killing him? Because we're already committed to killing him. Now we just need to make it look like it's legal. They're scrambling to find witnesses. The fourth way that they, or the fourth policy that they had to observe to protect those who are accused, is that they could not abuse anyone who had not been convicted. Yet in John chapter 18, one of the guards punched Jesus in the face. And you can go read that in John 18. Why he punched him and what Jesus said. Fifthly, the sentencing to convict Jesus on the same day as his trial was illegal. Remember, the new day began at sundown in the way that the Jews observed time. Sun went down, Passover meal ended, they went into the garden, he was arrested on that day, he went through all these trials. Really within the span of probably about 15 to 18 hours, he had been arrested, he had been tried, he had been condemned, and he was hanging on a cross. All in the same day, less than a day. It was illegal. Sixthly, and finally, the courts were not allowed to try and get Jesus to say something that they might use against him. It's very similar to our Fifth Amendment that protects us in the United States from having to give incriminating testimony against ourselves in a court of law. By interrogating Jesus, the Jews were breaking their own law because the evidence against Jesus was to be built on the testimony of witnesses, not the testimony of the accused. So this brings up two things. The silence of Jesus, and then the sort of witnesses that they had. So the silence of Jesus is very loud in the gospel narratives. He is so quiet. When he was oppressed and afflicted, Isaiah 53:7 says, he did not open his mouth. He is silent before Caiaphas. He is silent before Annas. He is silent before Herod. And he is silent before Pilate. Not once did he respond to the accusations made against him. There were a few comments made here and there, but he gave no substantial testimony regarding himself and the accusations. So this silence could probably be explained in part by the legal protection that he was supposed to be enjoying while he was on trial. But Peter explains that the silence of Jesus is actually theological. He says that it's due to the fact that Jesus had entirely put himself in the hands of his heavenly Father. Turn with me, if you will, to 1 Peter chapter 2. In the plans and the way that God devised history for this moment, the Lamb was to be silent. And after Peter describes how it is commendable for a man to bear up under unjust suffering because he is conscious of God, he then says, here is the example that you would bear up in such a way under unjust suffering. It's because Jesus set the example. Verse 21. To this you were called, to what? To suffer and to bear up under unjust suffering. Because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin. No deceit was found in his mouth. He had all the right in the world to protest his innocence, the illegality of the trial. But he said nothing. Why? Verse 23, when they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. He entrusted himself into the hands of a just God, even while he was enduring the injustice of men. So first of all, we see the silence of the Lamb, and then we also see in light of this that the sort of witnesses that they were bringing to the table. Well, what kind of witnesses did they bring to the table? Well, it says that they brought false witnesses. If you're going to jump back with me to Mark 14, look what he says here. False witnesses. Verse 56. Many testified falsely against him. So it's false accusations, false testimony, lies about Jesus. And then it also says that, verse 59, yet even then their testimony did not agree. So multiple times throughout the passage, what you're seeing Mark observe is that they were lying about Jesus. And then even in the midst of their lies, they weren't even coordinated. They were confusing the testimony about Jesus. So this was causing no short amount of frustration on the part of the high priest, which we'll get to in a moment. But these witnesses were not only giving false testimony, but they were also apparently lined up out the door. Look what verse 56 says. Many testified falsely against him. All kinds of people were eager to do their part in helping to put Jesus to death. This is interesting. Who were all these people? Because it was the middle of the night. It's not like it were just average Joes rounded up off the street that they had asked it right there. Hey, what did you hear him say? What did you hear him say? No, everybody was in bed. These were prearranged witnesses. So the question is, who are these prearranged witnesses? Well, it would be the people that Jesus embarrassed publicly over the course of his ministry, the teachers of the law, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, who no doubt when they came to him multiple times over 3 years to try and trap him, to use trick questions to trip him up and to be able to stand back and go, see, this guy's a fraud. And yet every single time Jesus came out on top and he outwitted his opponents with his answers. These are the guys that came with questions like, so Jesus, we got this woman, grabbing her by the scruff of the neck. We caught her in the act of adultery. Now the law says we should stone her. What do you say we should do? Go read John chapter 8 if you want to see how masterfully he answered that question. They're the same guys who came to Jesus and they said, so should we or shouldn't we pay taxes to Caesar? Right? Like, are you going to tell us that we should submit to this Gentile dog authority, Caesar? Knowing that all the Jews hate Caesar and submitting to him? Or are you going to say, or are you going to commit an insurrectionist act and say, no, we don't have to pay taxes? They thought they had him cornered. You can go read that too and find out how masterfully he answered them. But they asked him all kinds of questions. Jesus, if a woman were married to a guy and he died, and then he had six brothers, and she went through and married each one of them, and they all died, you'll remember from that passage, I would say, by the third or fourth brother, I'd be a little hesitant to marry that woman. She shortens your life. She goes through and she marries all of them. They all die. At the resurrection, Jesus, whose wife will she be? Huh? What's your answer, Jesus? They thought they had him. And every single time, they end up with mud on their face. Let me ask you a question. How do arrogant and conceited people usually respond when they're publicly embarrassed? Not well. Not well at all. Do you think they were looking for a chance to get him back? They found their chance. They found their chance. They were lined up out the door, and they couldn't wait. They gleefully told the Jewish leaders things Jesus did and said, hoping that their testimony would be the silver bullet to crucify him. But one after another, as they testified, it only made things worse because all of them gave confusing and contradicting testimony. This sham trial was not establishing the guilt, but the innocence of Jesus. The innocence, the testimony against someone will be built on two or three witnesses. They had them lined up out the door, and they still couldn't establish the guilt of Jesus. There's a theological irony here, and it's this. In order to convict truly the most innocent person in history, by their law, they themselves had to break their law. They had to break the law themselves, become guilty themselves of violating the law in order to get Jesus, who was innocent, condemned. They displayed the real corruption of their own souls in order to condemn the righteous one of God. And yet God was making use of their evil ambitions for his own purposes. The only man who was ever innocent of sin had to be condemned. Remember, listen, God's plan was to present Jesus, the sinless one, to die on a cross for sinful ones, all of us. Well, how are you going to get him on a cross? Well, you just allow the evil of mankind to play itself out as it interacts with the righteousness of the Holy One of God. Evil hates righteousness. Evil people will hate righteous people. Hated and despised Jesus, and given the chance, they were going to put him to death 100 out of 100 times. And so God was using their evil to accomplish his greater purpose. They thought they were ridding themselves of a blasphemer, but while they thought that, God was using their murder of Jesus for his own purpose to transfer the sins of mankind from man to Jesus. God was stripping the guilt off of man, laying it all on the head of the innocent one, and Jesus became a man, a sinless man, therefore, to bear the guilt for sinful man. God using, listen, God, you are not going to thwart the purposes of God. Evil men will be incorporated right into the plans of God. They will ultimately be thwarted themselves as he still accomplishes everything he sets out to do. Never will man ever thwart God. So we see the innocence of Jesus. Where are we at on time? We're doing okay. Next we have the identity of Jesus. Here's where we get the glorious confession. I should preach one sermon just on this right here. This is awesome. Look at verses 60 to 62 with me. Then the high priest stood up before them, and he asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. He gave no answer. And again the high priest asked him, and I would add in there impatiently, frustrated, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One, or not?" "I am," said Jesus, "and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." The right response in that moment from every breathing man was to fall on his face in worship of Jesus Christ. That was the right response to that declaration, to that glorious confession. So the high priest, he gets up. He's fed up with the crowd of false witnesses. It's getting him nowhere. It's not getting him to the destination that he set out with, and that is to convict Jesus and kill him. So he needs the route to get to the predetermined conviction or verdict of Jesus being guilty. So he stands up, he fixes his stare on Jesus, he point blankly asks him, which is the way he asks him is a way of putting Jesus under oath while he's on trial, and Jesus finally speaks, and when he speaks, it's glorious. He was silent, think about this, when they pestered him about his miracles. He was silent when they pestered him about his statements, about his preaching. Herod would kind of look at him and say, "Come on, just do a miracle for me, do something, show me." Right? I love the way it's depicted in the Passion of the Christ. But he wouldn't respond. He was silent. But listen, when he is asked if he is the Christ, the Son of God, he answers. And that, in my mind, is so significant. Who is Jesus? Who is he to you? Around a campfire, he asked his disciples, "What do they say about me? Who do they say that I am? Tell me, what are you hearing while you're out there?" And after they give him answers, Jesus looks them in the eyes and he says, "Who do you say that I am?" Right? The ultimate question of your life is who you say Jesus is. That is the question. Whatever your financial questions, whatever your marital questions, whatever your health questions, whatever your what you're going to do with your career or what kind of trajectory in life you're going to go questions, whatever big questions of your life you've got to ask and answer, there is none that even comes close to how monumental the question is that you must answer: who is Jesus? Jesus said, "I am the Son of God, I am the Blessed One's Son, I am the Christ, and I will sit at the right hand of God, and I will come in glory and in power. They said, no, you're not. Every single person has to answer that question, who is Jesus? And it matters for eternity. It matters for eternity. He says he's, there's a couple of things just that you see in the text. Look with me, if you will. He says, are you the Christ? The Christ is the word Christos. Okay, in the Hebrew, it's Messiah. Okay, and it's the word, the Hebrew and the Greek word both mean the anointed one. The one, and to be anointed was to literally, that's why you see in the Old Testament, whenever a new king was selected by God, like David, the prophet Samuel was told, go find David and you pour oil over his head. Anoint him, he's the new king, right? And the idea was that that person was being, that person or that object, that priest or that prophet or that king or objects in the temple were being anointed because they were being designated and consecrated by God to be used for God's holy and sacred purposes. They're special holy purposes. Jesus is the chosen of chosen ones. He's the consecrated out of all consecrated ones. He is the select out of all the select. He is the Christ. He is God's God, the one that God has elected to be the Christ and the one who would accomplish the purpose of redemption, the plan of redemption. He's not only the Christ, but he's also the Son of the Blessed One. The Son of the Blessed One. The Jews had a custom where they never say the name of God. It's too holy for man to utter. Don't say the name of God. Don't say the name of God. So the word blessed is a word that refers to someone who is worthy to be lauded or praised or spoken well of. The Blessed One, therefore, is a name for the God who is worthy of praise and worthy to be spoken highly of, but too worthy to say his name. He's so worthy, don't you take his name on your lips, the Jews thought, but he must be spoken so highly of. And blasphemy was to speak in any way that sort of minimized to any degree at all the glory and the laudability and the praiseworthiness of that God. Did you ever bring God down from his high and lofty height? That was the idea in the Jewish mind. So it is ironic. It is ironic that to respect God, extreme care was taken not to say his name and to use exalted appellations instead, while at the same time these same men were trashing justice and righteousness justice and righteousness and truth in order that they might accomplish some evil without any consideration how that reflected on the God of righteousness, justice, and truth. See, we can have customs that are good, but when they substitute actual righteousness, when the mechanisms that maybe we have in place become substitutes, and we begin to think of them as this is what pleases God, do you think God cared whether they took his name on their lips or not while they carried out their evil? God was not honored by their refraining from taking his name on their lips while they continued to while they themselves blasphemed his name by pretending to represent him while they were trashing truth with lies and trashing righteousness with wickedness and trashing justice with this sham trial. It's like Samuel was told, it's like God told Saul in 1 Samuel, he said, do I care about your mechanical sacrifices of offering 1,000 bulls to me, Saul, as much as I care about you obeying the word of the Lord and being righteous in your conduct? Don't give me praise from lips when the heart is far from me. Don't pretend with your religion and following all the mechanisms of your religion when you don't sincerely worship me. The flesh, as we talked about last week, loves fake worship. It loves mechanisms. It loves the form of spirituality, but it hates true submission to the righteousness of God. Jesus is the Son of Man. Now, we've seen Jesus referred to as the Son of David, here the Son of the Blessed One, the Son of God. But Jesus' most common and perhaps favorite way to refer to himself was as the Son of Man. No doubt he's identifying himself with the messianic figure in Daniel chapter 7 when Daniel says, "I saw one in my vision at night who was like a son of man who was approaching the Ancient of Days. He received from the Ancient of Days all power, dominion, authority, and worship from all peoples on the earth. All kingdoms were subservient to him. His kingdom is and his dominion are one that will never end." That messianic figure, Jesus was identifying himself when he calls himself the Son of Man. But I want to bring out that the title of Messiahship that this carried also was a title that's very personal for us because it indicates the humanity of Jesus. That Jesus took on flesh like you and I have flesh. That he came to be one of us. The Son of Man is a statement of God's own entrance into the human race for the purpose of saving the human race. So the Son of Man, that Jesus calls himself that more than he calls himself anything else, is a mountain of rebuttal against the Gnostics who would come decades later and say that Jesus did not come in the flesh. Yes, he did. Yes, he did come in the flesh. There was a man who came. He was a man, and he was certainly more than man, but he was certainly man. He was certainly man. What does it say in the Chalcedonian Creed? Perfect in Godhead and also perfect in manhood, truly man and truly God, of a reasonable soul and body like us, consubstantial with us according to the manhood, in all things like unto us humans, but without sin. But without sin. Jesus sits at the right hand of the Mighty One. I love how he says that right there. The right hand is a sign of strength, it's a sign of power, and it's a sign of honor. Honor. Jesus is the right hand of God. Ever since his ascension, Jesus himself is honored in that heavenly location and has all divine power in heaven and on earth. But Jesus came also to be the expression of God's right hand. What I mean by that is he came to express the power of God here on earth. He came to express honor to his Father in the way he conducted himself on earth. Jesus at the right hand of the Mighty One. So when we think of him, we should think of him as Ephesians says, seated at God's right hand, far above all authority, power, dominion, and every title that can be given in this age and the age to come. The contrast of Jesus on earth and in heaven is incredible. On earth, Jesus was not fit. He was not considered fit to tie the sandals of the lowest slave. But in heaven, he's exalted to the right hand of God. On earth, they were only going to lift him up to put him on a cross. But in heaven, he was lifted up to the throne of God. With their feet on earth, they trampled all over him. But in heaven, it is at his feet that all bow. Here's an application. How man treated Jesus is different than how God treated Jesus, and we need to remember that too. How man treats us is not an indication of how God treats us. Do not be surprised, Christians, at the painful trials you are suffering for being Christians, as though something strange were happening to you, Peter says in 1 Peter 4. But rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. Remember how God sees you, and it will not matter how man sees you. Remember what God has planned for you, and it will not matter what man has planned for you. Always, always our eyes are on the Lord. All right, I'm going to wrap this up here. Indictment, very short. Verse 63. The high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses? You've heard what he said. You've heard his blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him, blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, said, "Prophesy," and the guards took him and beat him, and off they took him. They finally have all they need. They condemn the author of life to death. Notice immediately the abuse begins, and they take him away. They take him away. There goes Jesus. And there go your sins. There they go. He carries them. God is on trial. And they made their judgment. And every single person also, in some sense here, is God's judge. And what will you determine about him? What will you decide about Jesus? They made their decision. If a person rejects Jesus, their fate will be the same as theirs. If a person puts off Jesus another day, that is a rejection of Jesus today. That is putting off salvation another day and risking leaving this life today without him. What will you do with Jesus? Here are some quick takeaways, one sentence takeaways to think about from this passage. Number one, don't blend in with the world. Don't blend in with the world. Comma. You can't stand with Jesus and not stand out. Secondly, remember that glory will follow shame. Glory coming is promise. Glory now is not. Thirdly, thank Jesus for what he went through for you. Fourth, suffer for him as he suffered for you. And if persecution comes, wear it like a badge of honor. Fifth, again, you are the judge of God. What will you choose? Let's pray.